Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're going to call our third case, 03AP2124D, OLR versus, is it Aliyah?
Aliyah.
And before we do hear from you, I do want to apologize that we've kept you waiting beyond the 1:30. Our cases ran a little longer than expected this morning. We have Robert Crone of the OLR for 10 minutes, then Terry Johnson for 25, representing Mr. Aliyah, and then Mr. Crone for 20, and then you for 5, Mr. Are you going to have 20 and then 5 in rebuttal? Is that how you're doing it? Who's doing rebuttal? Well, do you have the sheets here? Would you just check and see who's, whether the timing is correct or there's a mistake? Crone, 10 minutes. Johnson, 25 minutes. Crone, 20 minutes. 5 minutes, Johnson? Our sheet is wrong. Okay. I've got it right now. All right.
May it please the Court, Mr. Johnson. My name is Robert Crone. I am retained counsel on behalf of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. This case involves two appeals. OLR appealed the sanction, and the respondent appealed the merits of the case. And we happen to file our appeal first, so that's probably why I'm standing here right now first. We've divided up the time, as Your Honor has suggested. And I'm going to first address the sanction question because that was the subject of our appeal to begin with. This is a referee's report that is as thorough and comprehensive as one could hope for. And she ultimately concluded that the 5 counts pled by OLR had been proven to the requisite standards, that involving a false statement to a court, offering evidence known to be false, obstructing another's access to evidence, and assisting a witness to testify falsely. Concluding, as referee Kessler, now Judge Kessler, did, that there was an overwhelming impression, to quote her, that Mr. Aliyah had been attempting to keep information from the jury in the underlying case. Having said all of that, and having gone that far, the referee then issued a recommendation for sanction for 90 days. OLR had recommended 6 months. We stand by that recommendation. That is now a consideration for this court. In the narrow sense, the case involved but one civil trial proceeding, and Judge Schrader in the underlying case did non-suit Mr. Aliyah's client and impose sanctions and terms and costs against him. And in the narrow sense, the problem was cured. In the larger sense, though, the referee felt, and we feel, that what happened was really an attack on our judicial or adversarial system, because we're dealing here with tampering with evidence to influence the result in a case. We're dealing with confusing and contradictory statements to the court in the aftermath of when this problem was revealed, and we're dealing with scores of judicial time that were devoted to unraveling this problem. The conduct, in our view, was purposeful and undertaken by an attorney, albeit without any prior disciplinary history, had substantial trial experience and should be held to have known what he was doing at the time. These are not accidental modifications to an exhibit when you're talking about redactions and whiteouts. The ABA standards in such a case contemplate a minimum of a 6-month suspension, and the referee in this case suggested 90 days, relying upon the Britton case and the Hargrove case. We don't think those cases are particularly close to what we have here. Britton dealt with trust account errors and not falsifying evidence, and Hargrove dealt with one misrepresentation concerning a final account in a estate matter. The more appropriate cases that we think could be used as a touchstone for consideration by this court is the Donovan case involving a 6-month suspension, the Ness case, the Jackson case, and the Davidson case, all of which in some combination of one form or another involve some type of false information or false documentation presented to a court. Now, I would be the first to acknowledge that all cases, and we've both spent considerable time distinguishing these various cases, none of these cases are identical to our case here, and we use them as to be as an analogy, perhaps, to the kind of general conduct we're talking about. So in our view, an appropriate sanction is a minimum six-month suspension. Now, because my time is somewhat split, and I have a feeling that we're going to be dealing more with the merits of this case, I'd like to spend some of my 10 minutes devoted to that, and then I'll come back to that later in response to Mr. Johnson. This is not a case of whether an exhibit was redacted or altered. It's not a case of, because we know that happened. It's not a case of who redacted or altered it. We know that to be Mr. Aaliyah. The question, the threshold question, I think that we both agree on, was when the document was altered. Referee Kessler, as I said, in a thorough analysis, and I should preface my comments about her decision because she did on a couple of occasions, as Mr. Johnson pointed out, refer to a colloquy between Mr. Aaliyah and Judge Schrader that actually occurred on February 1 on a couple of occasions. She mentioned January 31 in her decision. That being a clerical error, I don't jump to the conclusion that that necessarily means her decision should be disregarded or given any less weight. The point is that when was this exhibit number 21 modified? First of all, it was modified on two occasions. Without question, it was modified for the first time before trial when one substantive price value was whited out of the exhibit. Nobody seems to dispute that. Thereafter, it's our belief that there were other modifications made to Exhibit 21 between the first day of trial, January 31, and the second day of trial, February 1. And the referee found that, and her findings are not clearly erroneous, and there are many facts that support that conclusion. For example, Mr. Olson, the other attorney, said he copied 21 only. He got 21 from counsel table after the first day of trial, marched to the copy room down the hall in the courthouse, made a copy that was ultimately marked Exhibit 24. Now, later on, we find out that Exhibit 21 has more alterations than the copy that was made by Mr. Olson following the first day of trial. Exhibit 24, that's the, trying not to complicate this any more than it is complicated, Exhibit 24 is the copy that Mr. Olson made of Exhibit 21 with the 24 sticker on it. 24 has the Exhibit 21 sticker on it. So those facts alone suggest very strongly that this is a document that was that this was the document that was copied, Exhibit 21, and that alterations that come up later had to have been made after it was copied, after the first day of trial. Also, Mr. Olson produced in the referee had in front of her Exhibit 5 in this case, which showed various dots, blemishes, marks, and other non-substantive information or markings on both Exhibit 24 and 21, suggesting that 24 had to have been a copy of the document 21. Furthermore, as I said, the most convincing evidence on this subject is the evidence from Mr. Olson and other courthouse people and his client to the effect that he was given one copy to copy. He went and copied it. He returned to the courtroom after the first day of trial. Mr. Aaliyah had expressed an interest in getting that copy, getting Exhibit 21 back when he went to copy it. And Mr. Clement and Mr. Aaliyah, or excuse me, and Mr. Olson, particularly Mr. Clement, had testified that they saw Mr. Aaliyah leave the courtroom on the first day of trial with that exhibit. In addition, the bailiff was questioned by Judge Schrader, who, following the first day of trial, returned the second day of trial and indicated that the tables, the trial tables, didn't have any exhibits on them. So, although this is denied by Mr. Aaliyah, I think that the fact of the matter is that there are critical facts here that cut in favor of the referee's determination that is not clearly erroneous, that the alterations to this exhibit occurred during the trial after the first day but before the second.
Why is that important?
Well, that's important because the alterations were during the second day of trial, when Mr. Olson was going to cross-examine Mr. Teibel, the adverse party, using Exhibit 24, Mr. Aaliyah objected, and he objected on the basis of foundation. And it's our belief that Mr. Elia, at that point in time, wanted the court to insist upon Mr. Olson using Exhibit 21 to cross-examine. And Exhibit 21 had been altered. And had he used that exhibit, he would have been hampered in his cross-examination, because those alterations that Mr. Olson had no knowledge of did deal with some very important critical circumstances in the case. So the importance of that is that it was a document that was already marked as an exhibit, albeit not offered, but it had been marked and it had been identified by the expert witness, Mr. Rooney. So as we know, at that point in time, court documents become somewhat sanctified when they've got that sticker on. And at that point in time, it was important that that document not be altered. And the alterations of it could have had and did have, I believe, some adverse effects later on.
Brown, now, I've got a question about the remedy being requested. You've appealed the referee's recommendation here. I'm looking at some cases cited by Mr. Johnson in his brief, the Kalal case, ROFA, and Private Reprimand 92-25. And given the circumstances that are alleged here, and at least Mr. Johnson's position is that Mr. Elia cooperated with the investigation and has no prior discipline, why would these cases not be more analogous to the situation that's before the court now?
Well, the Kalo case, I addressed that in our brief, and I recall the Kalo case dealt with the situation of misstatements to this court during oral argument. And my response to that was, and without for 1 minute suggesting that's not serious, but in the context of standing up here giving an oral argument, getting fed questions and being under their guns, so to speak, in terms of what you're doing, it's probably somewhat more understandable that one might misspeak in terms of facts or details when they're in an oral argument. Here, we have a different situation. We're in the midst of trial where a jury is ultimately going to be considering the case, and we have, as I said before, a rather purposeful effort to modify documents.
Yeah, but don't we have that situation in ROFA in Private Reprimand 92-25? As I understood, ROFA, at least the representations regarding ROFA, in a telephonic status conference, an attorney represented that he saw a witness sign an affidavit when, in fact, that attorney had not witnessed that take place. And then in Private Reprimand, you've got an attorney fraudulently doctoring two vehicle titles to reflect the name of his client, his homeowner, when that didn't occur. And as I understand, at least the representations, those were situations where there was cooperation and that these were first violations. So once again, I'm just trying to focus in on what separates this case from those two.
Well, I think what separates this case from those two, I'm not sure that all these cases match up in terms of the logic of the sanction. In all due respect to the court that makes the sanctions, but I think that we're dealing here with, as I mentioned, a trial setting where neither the court nor even the witness knows about some of these redactions, much less the other attorney. And I just think it's on that level it's more serious. That's not to suggest that the other cases aren't serious. And the cases that we cited also involve some of that as well, the Graspus case and so forth. I believe my 10 minutes are up.
All right, counsel. And you will be back for another 20.
I will.
Mr. Johnson, you have 25 minutes, and then you'll be back for 5.
Thank you. My name is Terry Johnson. I have the privilege of appearing before you to represent Mr. Elia, the respondent, cross-appellant. Mr. Elia is present in court along with his wife and several members of his law firm. This case I find to be extremely troubling. I find some of the suggestions that have just been made to you to be extremely troubling. For example, in answering Justice Butler's comments about the Kalo case, I believe that's the pronunciation, to suggest that that attorney was prosecuted because he made slips of the tongue in argument and inadvertently made misstatements, I think is simply not fair. I respect Mr. Cronin as an advocate. He's here advocating the position. But we all know that's not what happened. He lied through his teeth about factual matters to this court in an effort to get advantage. And you don't get prosecuted for misstatements. I was here a month ago. And in arguing a case, one of the attorneys, the other attorney, made a comment about what one of my experts had said. And I said, I thought that was an inaccurate characterization. I didn't think it was particularly relevant. It wasn't in the record. I would never have dreamed of suggesting he had misrepresented facts to you. So if somebody got prosecuted for making false statements of fact to this court, it wasn't a small slip of the tongue. And I suggest that to you, and I start off by mentioning that, because I think one of the things that runs through this case, from Judge Schrader, Mr. Olson, OLR, Mr. Cronin, the referee, is prosecutorial zeal, which has caused us to lose sight of the true facts. And I will give you another example. One of the points which Mr.
Cronin... What are the true facts?
The true facts here are as follows. Mr. Aaliyah hired an expert. This is an unusual situation because, unlike virtually every case I have and most of the ones I'm sure all of you have been familiar with, there was no provision for submitting expert reports ahead of time. If there had been, this issue would never have come up. There was no discovery undertaken of an expert by Mr. Olson. Shortly before trial, Mr. Aaliyah, in preparing for trial, realized that the relevant date for valuing this property, the issue in the case being a misrepresentation claim brought by Mr. Aaliyah's client against the seller of the condominium because they had represented they were going to put a golf course in, and he bought it, he said, thinking it was more valuable because they were going to have a golf course. One might debate that issue depending on how you feel about golf, but he apparently thought it would be better with the golf course. And they didn't put in the golf course, or they didn't put in an effective golf course. I think the evidence suggested they put in a couple of driving range and a hole or something, but not what most of us golfers would consider to be a golf course. The relevant date under the law was the day he bought the condominium. He was entitled to the benefit of his bargain based on the representation if he won. Mr. Aaliyah realized when he read the report and was getting ready to meet with his expert shortly beforehand that he had made a serious error. He had valued the property as of the date he was doing his appraisal in 1999, and that number was completely irrelevant in the case. The number which would be relevant was 1997. He got together with the expert, Mr. Rooney, about a week before trial, several days before trial. Mr. Rooney, the evidence was clear, was not only sick, it turns out he was dying. He was in very difficult shape. He had cancer, I believe. He was in very bad shape. In the course of this meeting, he explained to him the problem, and Mr. Rooney said, it's not a problem. Because the time frame is so short, I'd just be extrapolating back these values back to 97. The key point is the difference in value. How much less was the condominium worth? And the value with and without the golf course are going to go down by about the same amount of money, and the differences would be the same. Mr. Lee made it clear to him, and there was a comment about whether he should prepare a new report. Mr. Lee said that wouldn't be necessary. Between that point and the time of the trial, it is, I suggest, in any considered reasonable view of the evidence, absolutely clear that Mr. Aaliyah made all the redactions that appear in Exhibit 21. We had multiple witnesses who saw the redactions being made, discussed the redactions with Mr. Aaliyah, and had the redactions explained to them by Mr. Aaliyah before the trial ever started.
And the redaction, were these the principals in the case when you say multiple witnesses?
One of them was the client. Another one was a girlfriend of the client. Another one was Mr. McTernan, who was a partner of Mr. Aaliyah, all of whom testified. They saw this happen. They discussed it with him ahead of time. And the testimony of all of those witnesses was disregarded by the referee in this case.
Mr. Johnson, please stand in front of the microphone.
But what I meant was they seemed to be all on, quote, one side.
Well,
was it explained to the other side? I'm talking about the change of the exhibit.
No, the changes were not explained.
And isn't that what this case is about?
I don't think that's what this case is about at all, for the reasons I'm going to explain when
okay.
I'm done answering the Chief
no,
Justice's
no,
question.
No, I think we're on the same track. We want to know.
Okay.
I agree.
What are the facts? The facts
the reason
you say is all the redactions were made before trial.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
And the reason the witnesses are all on Mr. Aaliyah's side, of course, is that he wasn't doing this in Mr. Olson's office, he was doing it in his office in meetings with his clients and his witnesses.
Right.
So it's only natural they would be his people, so to speak, who would testify to this. But there never was any basis advanced to impeach them except one, the one the referee bought. And she said, because they didn't testify in the 2000 hearings, I'm disregarding their testimony. And as we pointed out in our brief, not only is that logically baseless, but it is legally not recognized. There is no basis in the law for saying that because witnesses didn't testify in 2000, you can simply disregard their testimony.
Also, if I may. Thank you. The maxim, of the credibility and the weight is to be given to the trier of fact. You know, in other words, the trier of fact decides the credibility of witnesses and the weight to be given to their testimony. And we, as reviewing court, if this were a normal court case, defer. And let's assume the same principle applies to the referee, the finder of fact here. Isn't your argument going to that she didn't give weight to testimony presented to her?
Because she didn't say she found them incredible or unbelievable. She said, I'm disregarding their testimony simply because they didn't testify in 2000. And there is no legal basis for that. That is an error of law. It is not a judgment as to their credibility.
Is there a difference between credibility and weight? I hear you respond with regard to credibility. Can't a referee discount and give less weight or virtually no weight?
If she had said in her decision, I have considered the testimony of these witnesses, and for these reasons I found them not to be worthy of belief, you would have to defer to that as I understand the rules. She didn't say that. She said, I'm disregarding their testimony for the sole reason that they didn't testify in 2000. A basis, it is as if she excluded their testimony. They couldn't be called in 2004 because they didn't testify in 2000, and there's no basis for that.
What witnesses were they?
They were Mrs. Aaliyah, who testified about the events that happened on the night the alterations ostensibly took place, Mr. McTernan's mother, who happened to be there that evening doing some free photocopying at her son's law firm, Mr. Tubal, the client, and Ms. Moore, the girlfriend of Mr. Tubal, all of which were disregarded, even though several of them had signed affidavits in 2000 saying essentially the same thing. So logically and legally, there was no basis to disregard that testimony, and she never said she found them incredible. She made some comments that suggested perhaps she thought Mrs. Aaliyah was a loyal enough wife to perjure herself for her husband. I've been thinking about asking my wife whether she would do that for me. I frankly think she would not. But whether she did or wouldn't, she didn't say she was incredible. She just made an implied implication that this nice lady back here committed perjury for her husband.
Counselor, what about the argument that the documents show that all the alterations could not have been done before trial started? What about that argument?
They don't show that because there's a perfect, because of two things. Okay. First of all, the physical evidence that was relied upon by counsel as showing these are all copies of the same document is not at all hard to understand because they're all copies of the same document. There is an original report that has been photocopied over time. So if the dots appear on the photocopies, it's because they're all photocopies of the same document. That means nothing. What is important is two facts. Number one, Mr. Aaliyah testified that one of his copies is missing, that it is a working copy, which would be consistent with Exhibit 24 in every way, except it wouldn't have the Exhibit 21 page on top of it. Someone would have to substitute that, number one. And number two, that copy was left in the courtroom at the end of the first day of the trial when he left, along with the trial exhibit, the copy that Mr. Olson had made, and he left when Mr. Olson and Mr. Olson's client were still in the courtroom, and they returned to the courtroom the next morning.
But if he had the original with the sticker on it.
No, he did not.
He didn't. Who's he? The client, I assumed we were talking about.
The original with the sticker on it stayed in the courtroom.
Did the judge have custody of them?
No, because it hadn't been offered into evidence. The exhibits were stacked up. And the only evidence which suggests otherwise is the hearing testimony, not testimony at this hearing, but the hearing testimony in 2000 of Mr. Olson's client, inconsistent testimony from Mr. Olson, which we pointed out in our brief. He has to characterize this several different ways, more favorably to us when the events were clear in 2000 than when he was testifying in 2004. And what Mr. Crone relied upon here today. What happened, again, to get back to the fact that there is a thread running through this, that because Mr. Aaliyah must have acted improperly, we lose sight of the niceties of the facts here. The record will show that when the transcript was attempted to be introduced, which we think was an error in many ways, One of the issues which came up is the statements by the bailiffs when the judge asked questions in court were not under oath and those should not be considered. Mr. Crone responded at that time that he wasn't offering those as evidence. They were just in there. Both in his brief and here today, he has again relied expressly on evidence that he told the referee he wasn't even offering for that purpose.
Let me just go back to the facts and let's see if I understand what happened, which I might not. A Rooney report was marked by the plaintiff, right?
Correct, along with many other potential exhibits.
Right. And it was Exhibit 21, is that right?
Right.
Sticker was put on it. The attorney questioned the witness about this report, Exhibit 21.
Actually, not. In substance, he questioned him about his opinions. There are a couple of passing references to the report.
His passing reference. I assume he held it in his hand, but it's irrelevant. They talked about Exhibit.
As a matter of fact, what they did bring out in the questioning was that his opinions that we expressed were not those that were in the report because the report valued the property in 1999. That was specifically brought out by Mr. Ali on direct examination.
So you have Exhibit 21 marked. Now, whether it was introduced or not, it still becomes part of the record, doesn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Who should walk out of the courtroom with that exhibit?
When? During the trial?
During the trial.
Unless the judge directs otherwise, anybody. I have pre-marked exhibits during the trial many times in my life and taken them home at night before they've been offered in evidence. Until they're offered in evidence, they're my documents. They're not the court's.
And Mr. Aliyah says he did not take them home. Is that right?
Correct. There would have been nothing wrong with him taking them home, but he just testified he did not.
Okay. The following day, does Exhibit 21 ever show up in court?
Yes, it was in court.
Okay, there it is. How did it get there? Do we know?
It was there because it was there all night.
Except for the bailiff, whose, you say, testimony should not be permitted.
Well,
okay.
The bailiff said there were no exhibits on the tables. The trouble is, the evidence is clear, that's not where the exhibits were being taken. So that testimony
was decided. Where were they being taken?
There was a counter in front of the clerk's office, a clerk's stand of some kind in which the exhibits were stacked and
leaked. Inside the courtroom? Or
inside the courtroom, correct.
Okay. So the following day, Exhibit 21 shows up.
Well, Exhibit 21 is present.
All right, is present. Okay. In addition to that, you have a Xerox copy that Olson says he made of 21.
Right? Which Olson says he made, and Mr. Olson says he made, and gave to his client to take home overnight.
All right. And that is before us as Exhibit 24, right?
That was eventually marked as Exhibit 24.
Okay, defendant's Exhibit 24. And there seems to be a difference between 21 and 24.
No question.
Okay. OLR's view is that your client made additional changes.
They have contended that for some time.
And who do you think made the changes? There were changes, so somewhere during that night, changes were made.
I think that if I'll be allowed to use the viewer just for a moment, I think I can demonstrate to you what happened is that either Mr. Olson, or I think more likely, I wasn't there, I don't know, but the logical explanation is that either Mr. Olson or his client took the working copy home and someone copied the first page of Exhibit 21 onto the other pages, so you had a bastardized version of Exhibit 21 that would be made to look like it had been altered overnight.
Either Olson or
his client. They were the only ones who were there. They were the only ones with the opportunity.
What was their motive? Why would they want to do that?
To get exactly what they got. A mistrial in a situation in which an expert couldn't really be shaken on the stand. The evidence had already come out. The expert had left. And the client of Mr. Olson specifically testified on his own that he thought this was the most important document in the case. If my client and his client had supposedly motivation to alter it, why don't they? It's
well,
the same
you,
trial.
Well, the way you explained it, though, it wasn't like your client was altering the document to slip something by someone. It was just to make the document timely reflect.
My client.
That was necessary for the burden of proof and a misrepresentation, which is the loss of the time.
My client made two alterations. I only had a chance to explain one of them. Basically, there are two alterations. One is to take out the 1999 references. The other is to take out references to the fact that his client then had the condominium for sale and the sale price that was being asked. One of the points, and that's important to understand, because one of the points which has been advanced here in quoting the referee is that this was an effort to keep important evidence away from the jury. I ask you, if you read this record, to ask yourself this question. What evidence was being kept away from the jury? The evidence of the sales effort was properly kept away from the jury because my client had brought a motion in limine that he knew would be granted and was granted by the judge at the beginning of the trial. So this whole argument that it was improper to keep that away from the jury is, I am sorry, sheer nonsense. It was not only proper to keep it away from the jury, it was required because the judge had ordered it before the trial started. The second element, the 1999 valuation, was not kept away from the jury. It was brought up by my client in his examination of the witness. Any juror who was listening would know that he had valued this property in 1999 and that his report dealt with that issue. The third issue that is supposedly being kept away from the jury is the fact that there was an argument that could be made that Mr. Rooney hadn't properly determined the square footage of this condominium to determine its value. That issue was covered by Mr. Olson in his cross-examination of Mr. Rooney on the first day of the trial. So the three points that are this overwhelming evidence that my client's motivation was to try to keep this away from the jury, in fact, are totally false. The only evidence that was kept away from the jury by any stretch of the imagination by these alterations was the very evidence the judge had ruled couldn't be brought out in front of the jury. And yet we have the referee, having heard all of this, specifically say my client's motive, shown by overwhelming evidence, was to hide evidence from the jury when he didn't, and we have counsel for OLR telling you that's what happened when in fact the record demonstrates it didn't happen at all. Simply didn't happen. It is
counsel,
purely fictional.
Your argument here, and I've read this a couple of times, I don't want to say it's confusing, but today
it's a confusing
court,
situation.
Well, today in court, here, you're saying that in your opinion, and you're repeating that the one that your client that accused Mr. Olson or someone in his stead made these alterations.
It is the only explanation for how we could have had an Exhibit 21 presented in court the next day, eventually remarked as Exhibit 24, which didn't show alterations which had been made on Exhibit 21 days before.
But the ultimate of that is that when you said, well, he made it for obvious reasons to bring these charges.
No, I didn't say to bring these charges, Justice. I said
okay.
To do exactly what happened, discredit the entire issue in front of the jury. The case ended up being dismissed. Sanctions were imposed. Mr. Olson's client got out from a verdict as a result.
I mean, let's put it this way. It's either, as you're, I don't want to say, this is shifting from one person to the other, but if Mr. Olson did that, obviously that is a very serious thing and would be treated in perhaps the same manner.
I assume it would be.
Yeah, yes.
And I'm not saying Mr. Olson did it because I don't have any idea. I can tell you the evidence is, if the evidence in the record, if you consider the evidence that was properly before the court and don't make the errors the referee made, indicates very, very strongly through four witnesses that those changes were made before the trial, multiple changes which can't be explained any other way, and from more than one witness that there was no opportunity on the part of my client to change on the night between the first and second day. But I'll do better than that. Let's just think about it for a minute. My client makes alterations in the document. He brings out the damaging information in part during his direct examination of the expert. The rest of it is brought out in cross-examination. The witness leaves. He's gone. The end of the day comes. If you believe OLR, there is an essentially unaltered Exhibit 21 there in court. He allows Mr. Olson to copy it and take it home. After he knows the opposing side has...
Just let me just stop you. That wasn't exactly a voluntary... a voluntary situation. Wasn't there, as I recall, he accused Mr. Olson of snatching it and running it off, or wasn't there?
No. Mr. Olson said, can I copy it? And he said, that's fine.
Okay.
But regardless, he knows when he leaves court that day that Mr. Olson has copied the unaltered document. So then he goes home and says, I'm going to create an obviously false document. And if you look at the original, it's not just redacted. It's redacted in ways that are obvious. I mean, it's way out. Anyone who reads it will see it's been changed. He brings it back into court. To what end? I cannot imagine, because Mr. Olson already has, under OLR's view and the referee's view, an unaltered document. And then, when Mr. Olson starts to question about it, he brings up the fact that he has an altered version of the document, bringing all of this down on him.
Counsel, just
what on earth would he be doing any of that for?
Just to clarify with regard to Justice Wilcox's question, I think that, at least as I understood it, your client asserts that Olson or Olson's client stole a copy of the Rooney report.
Correct, the working copy.
It says together with Exhibit 21, but you're saying Exhibit 21 wasn't stolen, it was given.
Right. It was the working copy.
And then your client is asserting that someone fabricated Exhibit 24 from Exhibit 21 and the stolen working copy.
And I'd like to show you why we know that.
We know that because we can compare pages in Exhibit 24 and Exhibit 21 in ways which make it clear that Exhibit 24 is not a copy of Exhibit 21. This document is a copy of Exhibit 21, the document that had the alteration just for a week. It has the name of the Mooney Group, obviously Appendix A before something was added here, as is my brand, Exhibit 21. So but the Mooney Group logo, it appears there. The copy of the same page in Exhibit 24 has the same portion of the Mooney Group obscured.
Oh, can I ask a question? Just so I see my colleagues looking through them. These are not the same. If they are,
one is Exhibit 21, one is Exhibit 24.
That's 24.
And that's what you're showing us, right?
Correct. I'm showing you today.
You're showing us? Okay.
I'm showing you page 884 from Exhibit 21, page 8139,
Okay. All right. Fine. Thank you. I need to catch up.
That happens when you duplicate sometimes.
Yes. And the explanation for it is the page is full over in a spirit part. And I ask you to look at Exhibit 21, page 884. Which is the original page. There's no photo. Didn't happen. That page, 8139, a similar page to Exhibit 24, the supposed copy of Exhibit 21, was not made by copying page 884.
So what's the difference between the two?
Between
Rooney and what you... What's the difference in those two?
The difference is the Rooney group below the lower right hand.
I know. What's the difference substantively? Anything?
There isn't any difference substantively. What we're doing is addressing the question, is it just my client who says Exhibit 24 is not a copy of Exhibit 21?
But Mr. Johnson, you argue that it's obviously a foldover. Many times you get exhibits where you have stickies on them. And could this not have been a sticky that would cover that section?
No evidence in this record at all suggests there was ever a sticky.
There's no evidence to suggest there was a foldover either.
That's right. Well, we have Exhibit 21, and we can see it wasn't folded over.
Right.
So we know it didn't come from that.
So you know it wasn't a foldover. But that's all.
Exhibit 21.
But that's all you know.
No, I also know there was another copy which disappeared in this process. The second thing I can show you, and I will tell you, because I need to use it to alter the exhibit, that Exhibit 24, as I have called it here, I have highlighted the page.
This is blurry.
Pretty blurry.
Yeah. I don't know why we're pretty well for.
How do we fix that? Maybe if you hold it. We have the copy. What are we looking at?
If you look at page 8146, which is a copy of page
right.
From the attachment to Exhibit 24.
Right. Better now if you want to move it.
Now it's clear.
Yeah, now you see that. What I've done is I've made more obvious a mark in the mark on the right side. Character, which I circled in the apartment, and his address has been copied so many times, it doesn't look right at all. There was a character in the page on Exhibit 24, copied from Exhibit 21, which simply does not appear in
What's the explanation? The explanation is this page, corresponding page, Exhibit 24 with Carrier, wasn't copied from Exhibit 21. It was copied from the now missing working copies, which, because it was a working copy, had no sanitations in some spots on it from my copy.
Mr. Johnson, if I could, there's one thing that's obviously troubling me and may be troubling some of the other justices. But according to your argument, Mr. Alia discovered an error in the report. It was referring to the 99 as should have been referring to 97.
Correct.
And it was based on that error that he went back and he did the redactions.
Correct.
Why didn't Mr. Alia present opposing counsel A, the original report, and B, what he was redacting, and discuss it with Mr. With opposing counsel so it would be very clear that we have a problem, this is how we're going to fix it, and so I'm giving you the original, and here's a copy with it's redacted so everybody's on the same page. If we wouldn't be here if that had happened, right?
And you get to the heart of what I intended to get to if I'd gotten through my prepared remarks, but I guess I'm not going to have an opportunity to do that.
I have just a couple of minutes to finish up.
I can answer that question specifically. If the question is, would there have been a better way to handle this, Mr. Alia admitted as much in the hearing. And I would not sit here and tell you that at some point in time in this process, it would have been better to sit down with Mr. Olson and do it. But two comments on that. Number one, remember, this is an expert who's going to testify where Mr. Olson has not even done a deposition and hasn't even asked for the report and doesn't even ask for it till afterwards. Now, in the cold light of retrospect, in a system that is not an adversarial one, it would be easy to say that would be what you should do. When an adversary is preparing for trial and his opponent hasn't done a deposition of the witness, there's no order that requires you to turn over the report, and he hasn't even asked for it, to say that one should then sit down and point out all these things to him so he will be prepared, I think expects more than some of us can deliver as adversarial counsel from time to time. But if there is simply no question that there were times when Mr. Alia, in best practice, could have done things which would have improved the situation. But we're not here to even talk about whether Mr. Alia was negligent, much less whether he was falling short of the best practices, a standard much higher than negligence. We're here to talk about, did he fall so far below the mark that his conduct is a violation of the rules? The questions you're raising, I don't think go to that. If he had offered the exhibit in evidence and never explained anything, that would then, in my opinion, be a violation of the rules. He never offered any evidence. There is no evidence he was ever going to offer it in evidence. And if I was the judge, it'd never get in, because it's hearsay. It is not admissible evidence.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Johnson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Crone.
Members of the court, at least I'd be accused of prosecutorial zeal. I want to point out this thing that was just over, this 139 that was just on the overhead, and because I haven't practiced the overhead, I made
just a post report. Well, we got a little problem. We need a microphone if you're going to leave the, and if you're going to approach the court, Mr. Johnson should come with you.
So you can see what's going on.
Yeah. Okay. I may approach the court. I think the Chief Justice.
We all have. Go ahead. What are you looking at?
Well, I'm looking at this document. If you can see a spiral line here, which
okay.
is the borderline.
Just a minute. This document, let's identify the record so we know
yes,
what you're
exhibit
talking
about. Exhibit A139.
From defendant's exhibit 24. Go ahead.
You can see the spiral line down the side there on what Mr. Johnson just showed you, suggesting to me that the document wasn't put in the copy machine straight. It wasn't lined up straight, and therefore the Rooney Group couldn't necessarily in the copying process be cut off.
Yeah, except A, page 139, was that put on afterwards?
That was put on after. Okay. That's an identifying mark by a SLR.
So that was put on after the copying. Okay. Is that why you approached the bench?
I'm sure.
That's why you approached the bench? Got it. All right. How do you explain the law we're talking about this? Well, how do you explain the carrot?
Well, I have no explanation for a carrot. A carrot could be a fuzz on the copy machine. It could be on the copy paper. It could have been added during the trial later. I point out the comments on Exhibit 5 that we offer to show the similarities. You know,
so Mr. Groen, if I could, though, just because I don't think we should. I understand what you just pointed out in that Exhibit A139, but if you take a ruler, if you take a sheet of paper and you run down the margins of where the pictures end, they don't line up where that end ends on Rui. So I don't think that answers it either.
Well, whatever.
Let me just interject. One of the things that concern me is I'm no expert on photocopying, and what weight should we be giving to these
issues?
Your suggestion that here this is an angle. I mean, to me, I don't know, and I'm not sure, with all due respect, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I'm not sure that that you have all the answers on photocopying either. I hope I'm not offensive in saying that. I don't mean to be.
I think we could look at this from looking at it, as I think some of the questions that were posed earlier suggest you could look at it from the other angle, and that is, what are the explanations for what happened here? And there's really only two. And Mr. Johnson in his brief really acknowledges that referee Kessler was right when she said there are only two. The two explanations are, number one, Mr. Aaliyah, as we believe, altered the document, Exhibit 21, between day one and day two of trial. And explanation number two is that Mr. Olson and or Mr. Clement, without knowing at the time, without having any clue that there's more than one version of this exhibit, somehow omnisciently thought it was wise to take one, to steal a separate one, and then collate them in some fashion and come up with a hybrid. No motivation, no reason to do that, no opportunity to do that. They were seen going down the hall to copy one copy, Mr. Olson, and came right back. And the referee rejected that as just a product of almost hallucination, I think. You can't fathom that as happening here.
Counselor, in regard to the facts, as the referee finds them, I know what our standard of review is, but what is the burden of proof that OLR must satisfy in order to have the referee make a valid finding of fact?
Well, I think we have clear, convincing, satisfactory burden of proof. That's easy to say. I don't think that we have to show motivation for what was done. I think there was motivation. I think the referee thought there was motivation. I don't think we have to prove it. I don't think we have to prove that these deletions were consistent or these redactions were proficient or thoroughly done. The fact is they were done. And here, the important thing, I think the overriding important thing is by deleting some of the 99 references, and this was a hasty job, no doubt, Mr. Olson would have been interrupted in his effort to discredit Mr. Rooney, the expert. Rooney had testified as to 97 values, but his report was couched in 99 terms. Mr. Olson could have made hay over that issue in front of the jury in argument or with remaining witnesses. The fact that, well, it might have been better to obliterate or change the 99 values and write 97 instead of 99, that really doesn't change our analysis. We must remember that there was no discovery. There was no production of this document. It's 50-plus pages, and it's popped on counsel in the middle of the trial. And so lots of things happened during trial.
Well, it wasn't certainly unexpected, Counselor, if you got a valuation case that you're going to have a report.
Well, it wasn't unexpected, but for whatever reason, it wasn't asked for by Mr. Olson. It wasn't produced. It just was there.
People practice in different ways, I think.
Yeah, I think better practice would have been to have this flushed out earlier, obviously. But The sales price deletions, while the sales price issues might have been out of bounds in terms of direct evidence, Mr. Tubal, Mr. Elia's client, was going to be testifying, and it could well have been, suggested in a prior motion in limine, could have been used to cross-examine him on value. Say, for instance, he would have said, well, the property is worth X, and yet he had it for sale for something else. Well, that sales price, which had been deleted in some spots, albeit not all the spots, could have been used effectively in that fashion.
How could it have been used in cross-examination when there was a motion in limine that precluded it?
The motion in limine only dealt with any direct evidence of it. It could have been used in terms of credibility issues or in terms of cross-examination, potentially, if needed. In other words, if there was a, if the owner expressed an opinion of value that was significantly different than what he had just listed it for, I think under those circumstances, the court would have received it.
Okay.
But,
thank you.
But the attorneys,
I've got a very quick question for you. To the extent that you know, I haven't looked at the record in the case yet. I've looked at the copies that the parties sent in. Do you know if the original document, Plaintiff's Exhibit 21 and Plaintiff's Exhibit 24, are in the record?
Oh, sure. Yes.
We have the originals here.
They're in your record. They're in your record, yes. Now, as far as Mr. Ali is the referee, you know, this is a credibility case. I mean, if there ever was one. And the referee heard those witnesses, and a lot of them were not particularly unbiased, law partners, wife, and so forth. And there was other evidence.
What about the witnesses that Mr. Peterson, Mr. Johnson said were excluded?
Were excluded?
Yeah. He said, quote, maybe I'm wrong, but I heard it, Mrs. Aaliyah, Mr. McTurn, Mr. McTurn's mother,
those
client and girlfriend.
Yeah, those are the witnesses.
Yeah. Were they excluded, or did she hear them?
Oh, no, she heard their testimony. They testified. But she did not accept their version of when the redactions occurred.
But she heard.
She, oh, sure.
She didn't just say, you can't testify because testify.
They testified at length.
Did she exclude their testimony because they hadn't testified in 2000? That's what I understood the argument to be.
No. She heard their testimony as to what they observed about this.
And did she disregard it because they testified in 2000?
She weighed that evidence, in my view, against other evidence. That evidence went to the question of when the redactions were made. And she weighed that evidence, in my view. I mean, the thought process is not totally spelled out here, but she had considered all that evidence and considered contrary evidence as well.
She did not exclude it. I think that's what...
You
didn't give it much weight because these people had not been presented before when this issue was a hot issue before Judge Schrader. Judge Schrader, following the hearing of the trial, when this exhibit problem came up, held a couple of hearings on motions. They were not presented at that time. They were then presented in front of Judge Schrader later, and Judge Schrader didn't consider that evidence in his decision because he felt it was untimely. And it wasn't new evidence. Judge Kessler, in this disciplinary case, considered everything.
She didn't say, I'm going to disregard this because they didn't testify earlier?
She said, no, she gave it very, she mentioned in her decision, I'd have to find that, but she mentioned in her decision that it was important to her that they did not testify earlier. Now, they had an opportunity to testify earlier, but the Judge Schrader didn't hear their testimony on reconsideration after his decision. Before the decision, they had an opportunity to testify. Why weren't they called?
Maybe they didn't think they were in so much trouble. Maybe what they did made sense to them, and they just thought it was a misunderstanding.
Oh, by this time, by the time those motions were considered, which were, I believe, in the spring, the judge's decision was made some months thereafter, by the time those motions were considered, it was quite clear that there was a significant concern on the part of the court over this exhibit issue.
Mr. Crone, did Mr. Rooney ever testify? I know that he died subsequently.
Mr. Rooney testified at the first day of trial. He identified Exhibit 1. He had a clean, full, unredacted copy of his report in front of him. He was handed Exhibit 1, unbeknownst to him. And he said later, when questioned by Judge Schrader, he didn't know that there were alterations to his report.
But he did testify then at some of these motion hearings in front of Judge Schrader.
He testified on the second day, February 1st, after this whole thing blew up, Judge Schrader called Mr. Rooney and asked him whether the subject of redactions was something that he had dealt with or knew about. He said, no, I didn't know anything about it. And he had previously identified Exhibit 21 as his report, unbeknownst to him at the time, was the fact that it really wasn't, in the sense that it had been changed.
Now, did Mr. Rooney actually testify, or was this a phone conversation that was then recited by Judge Schrader?
Both. He testified at the underlying trial the first day.
That I understand.
The second day he was called by Judge Schrader. There was an issue as to whether his testimony should be considered at this hearing. I don't think he was put under oath, but he was questioned by the judge, and the referee felt that there were circumstances to which she believed that was a reliable information, and he testified on the subject. It was fresh in his mind right after the fact.
Was it transcribed?
Yes.
And so that telephone conversation the next day, although apparently not under oath, was transcribed.
Yes. Well, that's in the transcript.
I know. I'm just making that point.
Yes. And counsel, Mr. Elia, had an opportunity to cross-examine the witness.
Now, number 56 of the referee's report at page A113 in Mr. Johnson's, part of the cross-appellant. None of the people who testified at the hearing on this grievance who said that they saw Alia make changes in the report on January 27, 2000 were presented to the court in May or July 2000. Victoria Alia did not testify at either the May hearing or the July hearing, nor did she provide an affidavit at those times, attempting to suggest Alia could not have altered Exhibit 1 on the 31st of February 1. At least on a quick reread of this, that's the only thing stated, and it appears as if they testified. She doesn't say they were excluded.
Yes, they did testify. Their opinions were not given much weight because...
Where does she say that in this? Does she say that anyway?
I'm implying that because she rejected their testimony because if they had important things to say, one would ask, why weren't they called earlier when Judge Schrader was dealing with it?
Counsel, I want to focus on that because I think I need some clarification. As I understand it, and I look at in the same appendix, paragraph 43 of the findings of the referee, she indicates in paragraph 43, that is the referee, several witnesses confirmed seeing Alia making whiteout changes to report on January 27th. And the chief just focused on 56. I assume, with the exception of perhaps his wife, none of these people who testified at the hearing who said they saw Alia make changes in the report on January 27th were presented to the court, etc. My question is this. It seems like Mr. Alia concedes that he made changes on the 27th, and he explained what those changes were. And that the changes on the 27th are, if you will, of not so great moment. Rather, the changes that are being asserted to have been made after the trial started are of greater moment.
Well, we disagree these changes were made on the 27th. I wish to point out paragraph 74 also deals with this issue of the witnesses that they called forward to testify. The changes were made later, and the fact that they were made later is clear by the fact that Exhibit 24, which is a copy of 21, doesn't contain all those changes. Remember, I spoke about two sets of changes, so that is the importance of that piece. We have other issues in this case.
Tom, before you move to the other issues, I've got one other question that is troubling me that you may have an answer for with respect to Exhibit 21 and then the photocopy Exhibit 24. And if you would take a look at Exhibit 21, the cover page A48, if you would, please. I'm looking at what appears to be a handwritten EX21 with a circle that is located on the underneath the photograph on 848 in Exhibit 21.
Let me just, maybe I can cut short your question. These are things, these are markings I think counsel might have added later that have nothing to do with it.
Thank you. That's what I need. Okay, thank you. All right.
Confusing enough, but that that's not involved. The other issue here is when this, what was represented to the court, and the referee made a finding that, although mentioned January 31, it should have been February 1st, that he, Mr. Ali, redacted the report when he met with Mr. Rooney, which is of course the false statement to the court. And there's a transcript, of course, dealing with that, and Mr. Aliyah says, and I quote, "It was redacted when I met with Mr. Rooney on Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday afternoon." Now, that wasn't true. Mr. Rooney refuted that. It's clearly not true. And in order to defend against that allegation, they literally, I don't know if you read the brief in this regard, but they literally say that the court reporter reported it wrong. And the meaning of that statement really wasn't as it's reported, that he really meant something else. I'll let Mr. Johnson explain it. Suffice it to say, there was sufficient evidence here, and the referee rejected that explanation. The question, though, as to what the possibilities are here, what we're left with, I think we've already touched upon, and the referee touched upon, and whether these things represent Supreme Court violations, I believe they do. Under either version of what's gone on here, there's an offering of evidence known to be false. Rooney identified Exhibit 21 as his report, held it out as accurate, and later it could have been received, although he didn't know of the redaction in the report. The defense is that the changes are obvious. Well, again, this is a 50-page report that's popped on counsel in the midst of a trial. Mr. Aliyah acknowledges the redaction. Well, he only acknowledged the redactions after the issue came up when he attempted to be the good guy with the court and say, oh, Foundation would suggest that we should now use Exhibit 21, which was the altered one. And then there's a defense of his not actually knowing or appreciating what was going on. I think that there's a level of trial experience here that is shown in this record that Mr. Aliyah had that would suggest that he certainly should be held to have known what was going on. Obstructing access to evidence, count two, or misrepresentations regarding Exhibit 21. Again, this was not Rooney's work because it had he had a clean original. He had given, Mr. Ali had given 21 to Olson with one whiteout this day of trial, the second day of trial. He has Exhibit 21 with several whiteouts and redactions. This wasn't known to Olson. It wasn't known to Rooney. It wasn't known to the court. Falsifying evidence or assisting a witness in falsifying evidence. He changed Rooney's report without Rooney's knowledge. Rooney then essentially is falsely identifying his report as his when it had been changed. He elicited from Rooney 1997 opinions, although the report was couched in 1999 terms. And count four is a false statement to a tribunal. I already talked about that. And this is the question of whether he did all this with the knowledge and approval of his expert. Mr. Aliyah cites in his brief a part of the transcript where Mr. Aliyah tells Judge Schrader there's no dispute that Rooney did not consent to the changes. That's not the question. The full transcript, later on in the transcript, there are additional questions. He's asked, did Rooney have knowledge? And Aliyah says, well, we talk numbers. Then he's asked, did you discuss redactions? He says, I don't know. And earlier, I read you the quote, in fact, where he had said earlier, it was redacted when I met with Mr. Rooney, Tuesday or Wednesday afternoon. There's so many inconsistencies. Time doesn't permit me to go into all of the inconsistencies in what is offered to Judge Schrader and what the explanations are here. And the misrepresentations of the court get so frustrating here. Mr. Aliyah gets so frustrated. He knows that there's only one way out of this, and that's to blame somebody else. So who does he blame initially in front of Judge Schrader? He blames Mr. Olson, who has absolutely no reason to even know there's more than one report. And now who does he blame, recognizing that he's not a good target? He blames the client, Mr. Clement, who likewise didn't have any idea about changes in reports or hadn't, didn't even copy it himself, took it home. So there's a lot of facts here. I think the referee did a yeoman-like job in sorting them out. There was some concern about Judge Schrader's testimony. It was our belief, O.R.'s belief, that the referee should have the benefit of all the information, the transcripts and the testimony. And I want to just close by saying that this referee stood on her own in this case. I think it's somewhat of an insult to suggest that she was overzealous in her prosecution, she was the referee, or that she didn't come up with her own decision, that she rubber-stamped what Judge Schrader did. The referee said, and I'm looking at page 244 of the transcript, recognizing that I have already told you that I'm not going to consider the judge's opinions because, in my view, they infringe upon the requirements that the referee decide the case from the facts presented at the hearing. That's what Judge Referee Kessler did.
Thank you, Mr. Crone. Mr. Johnson. So did he exclude this or listen to it?
He listened to it and then blatantly excluded it on an improper basis. In addition to
the page reference to the record on that.
The findings are in 54 and 56. You pointed out 56.
Well, is there anything else other than 54 and 56?
43, 73, you pointed out before, 54 and 56.
Anything else?
No.
Nothing. They testified, she listened.
And then she said, I'm not considering their testimony because they didn't testify in 2000.
You have a page reference to that.
Finding 54. Finding 56.
Anything else?
No. Okay. Well, that's the only time we got her reasoning, is her findings of fact. That's the only clue we have to what she thought. She never said, she said with Mrs. Aaliyah, that she might be too loyal. With the others, the only explanation she gave is they didn't testify in 2000, therefore they are to be disregarded.
So what she didn't say those words, but she makes those as findings, and you assume that she wouldn't have made them as findings unless it was important to how she viewed the evidence?
She didn't provide any other explanation for why she completely disregarded their testimony, which was consistent and completely consistent only with one explanation, and that is multiple changes in this document were made before the trial ever started. The only explanation she offered is they didn't testify in 2000, and the answer is legally, what of it? I ask you this, and I mean no disrespect. This is a confusing multiple record. Justice Butler indicated he had not had a chance to read the transcript. There is simply no way to appreciate the serious charges against Mr. Aaliyah and the facts here without delving into the record. Evidence that should never have been admitted was admitted by the referee. Although she paid lip service to the business of not listening to what Judge Schrader's decision was, it runs through this. That's exactly what she did. She held Mr. Aaliyah to a standard of accuracy in his statements to the court that, God forbid, I should ever be held to. Mr. Olson made repeated errors and misstatements. I am sure inadvertent in what he said to the court. He had to be corrected by his father. He admitted at one point that his client had misstated the facts to the court. Judge Schrader made patently inaccurate statements because they were all upset, they were all talking about something that they were all excited about, and they made inaccurate statements. Yet every time my client said anything which in retrospect could be questioned, it is branded a lie. He didn't lie to the court. That is the most unfair characterization of this record you could make, and you can only appreciate it if you read it. On the punctuation, when I first read this and understood what we were arguing about, I thought to myself, I wonder if these justices dictate their decisions. And if they don't dictate their decisions now, whenever you were in private practice or you were trial judges, did you dictate your decisions? And you know what? When you do that and you get to the semicolon, you say semicolon. Even though you're dictating very carefully, you don't trust that secretary to decide where a comma belongs or a semicolon belongs, and it doesn't have anything to do with your skill versus hers. It's because it is not always very apparent when someone is saying something. Let me put it this way. How you punctuate that. And all Mr. Aaliyah said is, if you read the transcript as a whole, it is apparent I never told the judge that I had redacted this report before I met with Mr. Rooney. And the suggestion that he ever had is absurd. And there's only one sentence which, depending on how you punctuate it, whether you leave a pause between the start of a statement and the finish of it, that now is turned into him lying to the court. This is a case that from the beginning should have been seen at worst as a lawyer not exercising the best judgment about how to address a very unusual problem with a report. And I suggest to you that the appropriate thing should have been from the beginning for OLR to say, this could have been done better. It doesn't suggest unfitness as a lawyer. It doesn't suggest dishonesty. It suggests misjudgment, which could have been handled better. You should have taken it up with the attorney early on, even if that damaged your adversarial position. You should have explained it earlier on, and there would have been no issue here. But nothing that suggests Mr. Ali is unfit to be a lawyer or needs to be taught a lesson.
Mr. Johnson,
I would reprimand at worst, and now all it should be is a public reprimand.
All right, you've already addressed what I was just about to ask, and that was, assuming that we accept the findings and conclusions of the referee, what is your recommendation in regard to discipline? I heard you say public reprimand.
I agree, and I think there are conclusions by the referee that simply can't be accepted. It cannot be accepted by people who live in the real world and know what these proceedings are like, that Mr. Aliyah's occasional, less than completely accurate recitation of what we now know are the facts is a lie to the court. I simply tell you there is simply no way that can be sustained unless you're prepared to discipline Mr. Olson for doing the same thing and discipline Judge Schrader for doing the same thing, and no one's suggesting that.
Counsel, Chief, if I may.
Justice Bradley.
Someone's not telling the truth. Paragraph 66 of the findings say, Olson has been consistent and clear from the morning of February 1.
And that is a blatant misstatement, and I ask you to read the record in our brief, and you will see he has never been consistent and clear. He has changed his story in six or seven different ways, okay, and we itemize those in our brief.
So he's lying. Olson's lying.
No, he has not been consistent and clear.
Okay.
Well, he's lying. He has changed his story in several different ways, which we itemized in our brief, and I suggest to you a referee who reviewed the record with a fair and open mind could not possibly have said that Mr. Olson was consistent and clear.
With regard to this one area, though, if I may, that he was consistent and clear from the morning of February 1 that he only had and copied one document, that he copied it from the front to back, resulting in a reverse order copy, and that there were colored pictures and a spiral binder in the document he copied, and that he was in a rush to finish the copy so Aliyah could leave with the document, and that he returned the document to the courtroom.
And as far as that goes, he has been consistent and clear on those points, except during the hearing testimony, he said, I don't recall having the photograph on. That's an important point, because the working copy had a photocopy of the front page stapled to the front of it, because Mr. Aliyah wanted to remember which was his working copy. He was looking at one that he said had photographs on it, and later in his hearing testimony, in this case, he said, I can't say that that's true. With that one exception, on those points he has been. None of that says his client didn't take the other report. None of that says he didn't turn it over to his client that night, because he said he did. It wasn't Mr. Olson who had possession of it overnight. It was his client. But was he consistent and clear throughout this? Absolutely not. And we've demonstrated repeatedly in our brief.
And Exhibit 21 had a spiral binder, but the unmarked photocopy had no binder. Is that right? That's what the judge said.
The unmarked photocopy, which became Exhibit 24, would not have had a binder because it was simply a photocopy. My client had originally two copies of the report as given to him by Mr. Rooney, which, as I recall, and I'm going on my recollection, I may be making an inadvertent misstatement here, but as I recall, they both had spiral binders because they were provided by the expert. The photocopy didn't because, of course, you don't create the spiral binder when you photocopy it.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Crone, for what are always very difficult cases for the court here relating to attorney discipline. That concludes our argument 03AP2124D, OLR versus Aliyah. We are in recess until next week at oral argument time. The court will meet in conference room at 3:25.